Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Quality sleep optimizes recovery, helping professional and everyday athletes perform their best. Only the Sleep Number Smart Bed is proven to improve the quality of sleep and provides valuable insights that can be used to support overall wellness. Talent on a college team allows the best players to outperform their opponents, but in the NFL, everyone is talented. Players entering the draft need every competitive edge they can get, starting with quality sleep. Training will only get more intense as players transition to the pros, so to optimize recovery, they can rely on Sleep Number for consistent, high-quality sleep. Experience game-changing sleep with a Sleep Number smart bed only at a Sleep Number store.
This week's episode of Zero Block 30 is brought to you by our good friends at Hulu. Hulu is online streaming. If you don't know what Hulu is, now you're definitely fucking missing out. I've been watching the new show, The Handmaid's Tale. Can't get enough of it. It creeps me out, but it stresses me out at the same time because sometimes my wife wants to watch several episodes in a row. I can't do it. Makes me nervous, probably because whenever it first started out, I thought it was going to be something like Downton Abbey. Was not at all. It's just this intense-ass show. People getting hanged. It's pretty badass. It's like, I don't even know how to explain it. It's like a show I've never seen before, and the only way you can really watch it is on Hulu. So you got to get Hulu. You can get Hulu Live, which starts at $39.99 a month, and you get free stuff. You get to watch ESPN, Fox Sports 1, all kinds of baseball games, all kinds of NBA games. You can record with the DVR. You can do all kinds of stuff now with Hulu. It's not just streaming like some of the other places that you might get streaming service from. It's much, much better. Hulu.com. Start your free trial today. You get 30 days free. Hulu.com. Hulu.com. This episode of Zero Block 30 is also brought to you by our good friends at Black Rifle Coffee. Black Rifle Coffee is fucking dope. I've been drinking it for like 3 weeks now. I'm still not completely used to it. My body's not used to it. It's strong as hell. It's delicious. It's full flavored. You guys know when I drink my wine, I like it to be a full body red. I like this to be a full bodied black coffee. It's delicious. If you're not drinking this coffee, you're a silly person. You're listening to a military podcast. Buy your coffee from a veteran owned company like Black Rifle. They employ all kinds of different veterans. They give you today, if you're a listener here, you get 10% off with the promo code ZBT10. That's ZBT10. Black Rifle Coffee. It's good. They have all kinds of cool names. You don't have to drink some weird old mochaccino shit. It's not going to be some frappuccino with all kinds of unicorn-looking stuff. No, it's going to be real strong coffee for real strong people. Get some of that shit. It'll help you kill some Nazis, too, if you need to kill a Nazi. Shout out to killing Nazis. Got Nazis on the brain. We're talking a lot of Band of Brothers, so that kind of makes sense, right? I'm sure that those dudes would have loved some Black Rifle coffee. I would have liked it in Fallujah. I know that for sure.
Glad to be here, as always.
Yeah, man. Big day yesterday. Big time in the news. We are about to have a full-out episode where we talk nothing but procedure, what happens in a Senate, with Comey, how that all went down. We're going to get into the weeds about it because both of us were really concerned, so we hopped on just to speak solely about... Fuck that. No, we didn't. We're not going to talk about that. It's D-Day.
Tired of that stuff.
I don't give a fuck about politics right now. It hasn't even happened. We are recording specifically before that whole Comey fucking shit goes down because we don't want to talk about it. If something happens really important and something really big comes out, we'll hop back on later.
Sure.
Maybe do a special episode before I go to Disney World. We are going to talk about D-Day. We promised you, the listeners, that we are going to go over Band of Brothers because it's what I saw this week for the first time, and I'm pretty fucking stoked to talk about it. It's basically a full episode on D-Day. Later on in the show, you'll hear an interview we did with a major select, or as they call in the Army, major promotable. Peter, what's his last name?
Beer. Like the drink. Beer.
Peter Beer, yeah. So we have him on to talk about some lesser-known stories from D-Day and surrounding, and then we even head over to the Pacific for one last Marine Corps story. But you're going to enjoy that. Let's get right into it. You ready to get down to the business on Band of Brothers?
Dude, I am pumped because I have seen this series no less than 20 times all the way through. I am thrilled that you have finally got your act together and watched it, and it's blown people away that you hadn't seen it before. Just for how critically acclaimed it is, how well done, and just everyone always says it's great. So I'm excited to be talking about it.
And I think I've said before, I just don't I'm not a huge war movie person. Yep. I wasn't before I joined the Marine Corps, and I didn't become that way. And
sure.
Even my friends in the Marines, they always thought it was weird that I just didn't give a shit about any of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I had always thought that I'd saw Band of Brothers because I saw Saving Private Ryan.
Sure, sure, sure.
So, but it's very different. I am going to be honest. I'm terrible with names. You know that, Connor.
That's okay. All,
I mean, you just saw it a minute ago. We just talked to the dude like 10 seconds ago, and I couldn't remember his last name. I'm like the worst with names ever. So I'm going to refer to a lot of the characters by some of the more famous roles outside of Band of Brothers.
Yeah, yeah. You like, know what, though? I think a lot of people know that too. Yeah.
Captain like Sol will be Ross to me. Yeah. The lieutenant is going to be Sergeant Brody from Homeland.
Yep, yep, yep.
That's just what I know him as.
That's all
we will
good.
Get down to it.
And so, also because, gosh, it's so funny, because I knew we were going to talk about this, and we had said a while ago, like, hey, we'll save it for D-Day. But so many people, like, tweeting at us, like, hey, are you ever going to talk about Band of Brothers? And I just want to be like, be patient. So we appreciate your patience, and now here we are.
Yeah, we are going to do two episodes a week for the next, I guess that'll be 5 weeks. It's 10 episodes long, mm-hmm. Right?
Yep, yes.
We're going to do two episodes a week for 5 weeks. And then after that, maybe whenever we'll roll into the Pacific, whenever the Pacific Theater around December after Pearl Harbor time, whenever we reach that, that's when we'll take a little break and then we'll come back and do a little bit more in-depth action. I have seen Pacific, at least half of it. I think I stopped watching it for some reason.
I did, so too. I'll have to go back and rewatch it.
Okay, that'll be good.
But I'm happy to do that.
Well, let's get into it. One of the very first things that when you see the opening of Band of Brothers, blew my mind how young the actual veterans looked because it came out in 2001.
Right.
And I didn't know this, that the first episode aired 2 days before 9/11.
Right. Yep. Yeah, so that Sunday night. That it was Sunday, September 9th.
Yes, so. And obviously 9/11 fucking terrible and everything like that. But the sense of patriotism that happened right after 9/11
mm-hmm.
had to affect how people felt about Band of Brothers,
without
too,
a doubt.
Patriotism was at like an all-time high for our generation.
Mm-hmm.
This story is coming out about American greatness, about American warriors. So it really played a part. But when I saw these gentlemen, because it was 15 years ago, these guys that are 90 now were 75. Some of them were in their early 70s. So they didn't look like the World War II veterans that we see
mm-hmm.
now. When you see now, you're like, that's a World War II veteran. They look old as fuck.
Sure. And a lot of them, the guys that they profiled in Band of Brothers have since passed, which is a shame. So it's, I think that is probably one of the best parts about Band of Brothers. You know, Stephen Ambrose wrote the book. And he actually had nothing really to do with the miniseries. It was all Spielberg and Tom Hanks. But for them to include those gentlemen to give those firsthand recounts of what was going on, I think was so special. One, to lend authenticity to their story that they were trying to tell in the miniseries. But two, just to honor them and allow them to tell their story on such a grand stage that is, you know, HBO.
And it was really important that they set the stage that this is not just a fucking TV show.
No.
This is, we tried our best to make it as accurate as possible
mm-hmm.
to depict the stories of what guys like this went through. This is really what happened. It's not just a show. Because you have that a lot with war stories and Westerns and shit like that where you lose sight that this happened to real people. This was real fucking dudes and women that were at home, like, while their husbands were doing this shit. It's
mm-hmm.
it's real. And these are real faces. Whenever the guys would get choked up, man, I would get choked up right along with them.
Sure.
Let's get into it. First episode, after the real part starts and they hit that theme music.
Oh, that theme music, though. Oh.
The theme music will get you.
It'll get you right in the feels, man. Oh.
The very first, I think the first scene that they opened at is they have, I think it's a lieutenant standing on the back of a Jeep saying, "We're not going to jump today."
Right.
Something like that, right?
Yep. Seeing how the order had been, and obviously true to form, it had been delayed due to the weather because they were waiting for the channel to clear with all the fog. Because they were jumping in. So, you know, they need some sort, even though they were jumping in at night, they need some sort of visibility. They can't just jump into nothing.
Yes, and then they jump from that scene to where Captain Sobel is going through the inspections before they are going to get their weekend pass. Mm-hmm. One thing that pointed out to me, that shit would never happen in the Marine Corps. Never.
Which, well, what wouldn't happen? Him going through it, you're saying the
officer's yep. not inspected in the platoon at all. And the fact that he inspected an officer or the platoon sergeant in front of the platoon and listed out their discrepancies, like the sergeants and shit's discrepancies, that would never happen in the Marine Corps. We do our junior troops, E5s and below, and then E6s and above get inspected separately because you don't want the discrepancies of the senior leadership to be called out in front of the junior troops.
No, it totally undermines their leadership. And, you know, nobody's perfect, but they have to set the example. And if you're just
so I wanted to ask
out,
you, do you guys do that? Would you be the one inspecting in uniforms ever?
I didn't do uniform inspections anytime I was in the Army. Once I graduated, we did uniform inspections at school.
Right.
But
school
not,
all the time.
But not in the Army. All that stuff, you know, what we used to do that would, I guess, be comparable with PCCs, PCIs, pre-combat checks, pre-combat inspections. And that was all done by my NCOs. I rolled up to my platoon and my platoon sergeant or one of my...
You expect it to be done correctly.
Oh, it was... Yeah, absolutely. No. They just tell me, hey, sir.
I would flip the fuck out if I ever saw...
Right, yeah.
My captain going through and inspecting, being like, your uniform's fucked. That's not your job. Like, that's not what you do. Mm-hmm. You give the plan to me and then I give it to our guys.
Bingo.
That was another thing that I saw, that they were all briefed together as like a platoon or a company. And that's pretty rare for the Marines as well. Usually it's going to be squad by squad or platoon.
Right, right. You might get a company wide or a troop wide quick announcement, but then your platoon
is
going to
be very, very broad. Yes. This is what we're going to do, gentlemen. We've already briefed your leadership. They're going to tell you how it's going to go down. We're going to do this, and we're going to do it well. It's what we've been training for. Very broad overview. Nothing specific.
Sure.
All right, so.
And he was just a dick.
Sobel, what I did like about Sobel, if you put Sobel, this might surprise people. You change the rank from Sobel from being a captain. You make him a staff sergeant. I changed from hating Sobel in most parts, especially at school, to loving him.
I would probably agree with the majority of that. I'm not a huge fan of just the tone he took. I don't know. Maybe that's just my style, because it just seemed like he was abusing his rank. So maybe that would have changed had he been a staff sergeant. But it just seemed like he was abusing his rank and screaming and being a jerk because he felt like he could. And also, he probably felt like that was good leadership. Correcting them in that manner was probably good leadership, but I don't think it was.
If you change Sobel to a staff sergeant and have Sergeant Brody, what's his name?
Lieutenant Winters.
So you have, if it was Staff Sergeant Sobel and Lieutenant Winters as the platoon commander, that would be a great dynamic. A dickhead with somebody who is more kind and wants to build people up. That's a great dynamic to have as far as officer enlisted, where the enlisted guy is just a hard ass. And Sobel went too far in a lot of areas where he was just trying to, there was never a build up stage. It was constantly a breakdown stage where he would try to look good.
Right. And the attention to detail is important. And I think a lot of times when you're doing silly things, you're using that as a tool to teach attention to detail, because when you're in combat, and, you know, you're off, you know, calling for fire, as an example, by a couple degrees, that could be a really big deal. You need that attention to detail. So it's using that as a tool for your uniform as a way to teach that. But, again, he went too far, and it was like there was never that point where he pulled someone aside and said, hey, do you know why we're doing this? It was just constantly berating them.
Like, if you have school, like if jump school goes 11 weeks, whatever they went to, and then for the first 9 weeks, Sobel acts exactly the same as Staff Sergeant Sobel. Mm-hmm. And then the last 2 weeks, he eases up, explains to him what the responsibilities are going to be, why he's been kind of a dickhead to get to that point. I love Sobel if he does that. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't do that. He is the officer. The officer has a responsibility to be a gentleman and be a leader and create an environment where people can learn and become tactically proficient.
Right. And there's all different ways to be a leader. I think... In my opinion, I think part of being a leader, there is some extent of it that is just inherent. Some people are born to be leaders and have natural instincts that allow them and facilitate them being leaders. But also, I think being a leader, you are a collection of the folks who have led you before. So you take little bits and pieces from other people and learn from them, and you create your own style. I can't imagine Sobel, and his actual family had some complaints because they said that he was portrayed poorly, but, you know, I'm sure Hollywood took some liberties, as Hollywood always does.
Oh, all these names are real?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yes. These are the actual names, actual people.
Oh, fuck. I didn't know
Oh,
that.
Yeah. Sobel was an actual person.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Fuck, that's a rough way to be portrayed. Like this.
Yeah. So you can imagine his family's upset. But yeah. And another interesting fact, Spielberg had a lot of those guys.
Second most shocking moment probably in ZBT history, besides the fact when I found out that Arnold Palmer was dead.
Hey, chaps, he's dead. That was great. But Spielberg actually had a lot of those guys on set. And if they were directed to do a certain thing or say a certain word, and the gentleman that they were portraying said, no, that's not how it happened, Spielberg said, I don't care what the direction is or what the script says. If your character or your person you're portraying says this is how it actually happened, you do it that way. Because that's how authentic he wanted it to be.
And that's what we say in ZBT theater all the time. Like, have those guys on the side. Obviously, you can't have the person that you're portraying there all the time.
Sure.
But have, like, a liaison. That's what made it so fucking good, is because the dialogue is great.
It's very,
like,
genuine.
The dialogue from person to person doesn't feel forced at all.
Yeah.
It feels like accurate, like how you would actually talk to each other.
Yeah. And another thing, they all had to go through like a boot camp. I think it was like about 2-week boot camp. And he kept Sobel, Ross, separate from those actors. So they would have a little bit of resentment towards him that he wasn't going through stuff that they were going through.
And shout out to Ross when he was running in those short shorts. He had some tree trunks. He looked like he was actually getting after it and going up those hills, swinging his arms. I like that.
Ross definitely looks
one
like he's a
little
athletic.
One thing I did like, too,
what's
as
that?
as a staff and CEO, one thing I did like, when Sobel makes up the fact that there's creases on the bottom, and the kid is like, I didn't have my shit creased. There is no creases.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it, because that used to be a tactic that we would use all the time. Say something's messed up. The kid's looking at it like, no, it's not messed up. He knows that it's not messed up, but you're still telling them that it is, just because you know you're going to take their liberty away.
Sure.
Take away.
Just see how they react.
Yeah, you want to have some angry people. One thing, huge difference between what we would do now and what we did then. Sobel saying, making him go on another 12-mile hike because he drank from his canteen.
Mm.
Completely flip-flop now. If you came back and you still had too much water, you would get in trouble now because you weren't drinking and hydrating enough.
But I think that was a great example. And Sobel, this was happening probably not because Sobel wanted it to, just by as a byproduct of his crummy leadership style, is they came together even more tightly because they all resented him so much that when that guy, I forget who it was, when he had to go back and do that march again, all his platoon mates and company mates joined him. And they're like, oh, we're doing this. You're doing it. Then we're all doing this together. And that really struck a chord and resonated with me, and something that I really appreciated, because it truly embodies the band of brothers moniker that they had.
Yeah, I also thought that it was a strange moment moving forward in the evolution of the first episode. Whenever they were done with school, they were going to their actual field operation portion where Sobel was being involved. And Sobel makes the mistake of leading them right into an ambush, even though the lieutenant tells them not to.
Yeah.
Like that this is a classic ambush situation. Boom, they get ambushed. I thought it was strange when the lieutenants were really jumpy around him. Like whenever they were back into the hut where they were all meeting, and then Sobel walks in.
Yep, and he's eating that apple.
That's not usually what happens, because usually officers have, at least in my experience, have a more open type of relationship where they're going to discuss things.
Oh, absolutely. But I've been in a scenario like that where there was an officer, and not that he was a jerk, but just we didn't necessarily agree with a lot of the things that he did. But It is difficult when you're walking on eggshells like that because as...
You can't have that.
No,
like,
you can't.
Amongst the leadership, you can't have
no,
that.
No, you guys got to all be on the same page. You might have some differences here and there, but you have to all be on the same page and you have to respect one another. And ultimately, you know, the jokes they would make about Sobel, the digs, I mean, that's just not... That doesn't make for good leadership when you have zero respect from the orders, because then it gets to the point where even if he's giving you an order or telling you to do something that is absolutely correct, you might ignore it or want to go the other way just to spite him. And that's obviously not a good tempo to set.
No, and it's on both sides. You don't want to be where you have to talk bad about them behind their back. And you, as the leader, you don't want to have that. As the ultimate leader, like Captain Sobel was, you don't want to have your troops feel like they can't tell you when you made a mistake. Like if you want to come together, and you have to have that, foster it, like especially with your direct subordinates. Maybe you're not listening to the PFC or the Lance Corporal who's telling you what you need to do, but you definitely should be listening to your lieutenants and your staff and COs at that point. One thing that people, I want to also, while we're going through this, kind of explain some of the tactics and tactical words that you might not know that we think is common sense. Explain
we've talked about that by the way. You know, we watch military movies and I pick up on, you know, everything because I know the lingo. I understand the language they're using. And I just think, gosh, I feel bad for some people who just won't appreciate this as much when you hear certain dialogue just because they've never experienced it before. So what were you going to use as an example?
Here, I just want you to explain what the difference between cover and concealment is.
Right. So you got cover is something that will actually stop a round potentially and protect you, whereas concealment...
Stop a bullet.
So think of like a big boulder, whereas concealment might just be a pretty thick bush. Where if you're looking at it, you're not going to necessarily see me, but if you shoot through that bush, you're still gonna hit me.
Right.
Very
so
big
it's kinda
difference.
Like if you're standing in the middle of your yard and somebody's doing a driveway, you have cover if you're standing behind your house. You have concealment if you throw up a blanket.
Exactly. Like, yeah.
One of them's not going to work in both situations. Cover does oftentimes provide concealment, but concealment doesn't give you cover.
Correct.
All right. So my favorite scene probably of the first episode is whenever the kid does a mocking voice of Major Horton.
Yes.
I think everybody knows. He's like, what the fuck is the holdup? And I think that every single platoon has guys who can mock their like leadership voices.
Oh, absolutely.
I used to do it all the time to my first sergeant.
Absolutely.
And I was a sergeant filling the company gunny role, and a staff sergeant was like four doors down. And I could do my first sergeant's voice pretty well. Mm-hmm. So I'd be like, hey, staff sergeant, get your ass in here, dog. he would come running. He's like, yes, first sergeant. He's like, it was fucking company gunny.
Yeah.
You're like, God damn it, dude.
You got
like
me
five or six times a day, because he would do it to that staff sergeant over and over again. Mm-hmm. And then I would just do it like when first sergeant was gone, and he would come like, you motherfucker, dude.
Yeah, but then he cuts the fence and all the cows run amok, and he's getting chewed out back at headquarters. He's like, well, Major Horton told me. He's like, really? Because he's not even here right now, so I don't know how the...
Major Horton told you, huh?
Yeah.
Well, Major Horton's on leave in London.
Yeah. So that's pretty damn difficult for Major Horton to tell you.
And Sobel's face when those fucking cows are walking by. Yeah. It's so goddamn perfect, man.
No, but you're absolutely right. There's always that dude in the platoon or in the company who could just, one, always get a laugh out of everyone, but two, definitely imitate the leadership. I actually had a kid like that in my platoon. One of the tactics I would use to develop my E4s, before, you know, they were going for sergeant, is I would separately brief them the op board before we were going out on a mission and said, all right, you got the op board today. And I would obviously be standing there, the whole platoon, and I'd be standing right there to make sure they get everything. But I would let them give the op board to the platoon as a way to just get them comfortable being in front of a group and providing a leadership report. And there was this one dude, man, Becerra. So now Sergeant Becerra. And the first time he did it as me. And he was giving the actual order, but he was also somewhat mocking me.
Yeah.
Just to keep things light. He was using some words that I had been using a lot recently. He threw his voice a little bit to sound like me. he exaggerated some things, and it was. I think I might
was
have
he
a video
really
of it.
Fancy.
Yes, yes, he did. He his uniform was looking perfect that day.
Another part that I really liked was the old man. Whenever they're coming out,
oh yeah,
and he's riding his bike,
yep,
and going several different directions. Because it reminded me of a time when I was in Iraq and we were doing shit under the cover of darkness, and we came up to a canal, and like people would piss and shit in the canal like at nighttime. It's just what happened. And so the dude like pulls up his pants, he goes in, and then he turns around and sees people like in reconnaissance gear, like night vision goggles, silent, like suppressors on their weapons and shit like that. And he just like, oh fuck. And he turns around and goes the other way, and then another team of us come out, and we just have like the whole area engulfed. And
yeah,
it was kind of like that guy. And he was just like, "All right, I'll go back inside."
Because you got me, time, you got me, Americans.
Yeah, like at that time in Fallujah, you weren't supposed to be outside, and really, if you're outside past curfew, you mm-hmm. could be shot.
Right.
And so it was clear to us that he was just taking a shit, and we're not going to shoot you for taking a shit, like
right.
Especially not me. I've had diarrhea since Easter of 2007, so I'm not going to do that.
But that was also a great example of just Lieutenant Winters, man. He was just squared away, and his guys respected him. And something that I didn't realize until recently was, Chaps, you were just doing something. You were bouncing around on your hiney. You're
yeah,
right?
I'm excited about my next point.
Oh, okay. I was just going to say.
I'm reading through my notes. I actually took notes watching the show, so I'm ready.
Fantastic. But Lieutenant Winters was only 26 years old, which in the grand scheme, and when you consider what
that's
all
a pretty
they
old
did,
lieutenant though.
Yeah, but I think that was a product of the fact that guys were joining up after Pearl Harbor, and a lot of guys said like they saw the article in Time magazine about, you know, being a paratrooper, and it was like, hey, you know, we're going to be the best and tip of the spear. So some guys were like, well, if I'm going to go join and fight the Germans, why not be part of the best unit? So it was a little, that's definitely old for a lieutenant, especially now. But I think that was a little more common back then, that the ages really didn't coincide with the ranks as much as they do now.
Here's what I wanted to talk about. I love this. And if you're a young troop, listen the fuck up. When Winter goes into Sobel's office and Sobel wants to court-martial him for doing something wrong, he's like, just take it, whatever his first name is, and be a man and take your punishment.
Yep.
And he says no and signs the court-martial. So many young troops should do that shit when they get like page 11s and stuff like that. When you know you're getting screwed, because most of the time, your battalion commander is not going to want to submit that to court martial either.
No.
If you request for court martial, a lot of times you're going to get off easier. They're just going to let it go. Like they just are. I used to tell my Marines all the time whenever they would do something that was kind of stupid, like underage drinking or something like that, mm-hmm. like just say that you're not going to take the NGP you wanted to go to court martial. Did they take your blood? No, then they can't fucking prove it.
Right.
Take them to court martial.
Right.
If you did that, there's nothing that they could do. Like,
yeah.
Because they're not going to do it because they would lose. Like in a court martial setting, they would lose.
Yeah. But that was also, well, let me ask you this. What did you think when the NCOs got together and said they were going to resign if Sobel stayed in leadership?
Because of the mistakes that Sobel was making were so tactically egregious, I don't have a problem with that.
Okay.
Like, I feel like if you're not doing your job if you're setting your junior people up for failure. So you can't, if you know that the person that you're following doesn't know what he's doing, he never knows where he's at on a map, he doesn't know tactics, he's fine at teaching people at school, I think that it's okay. I think that what they should have done was approach the XO, but the XO had been relieved.
Mm-hmm.
And if I was them, I would have approached it a little bit different, probably not all of them together. Signed a letter or something like that, but I don't have a problem with the principle behind it, because your responsibility as an NCO is to look out those junior for you, not the one senior.
I agree with you. No, and that's, I mean, I think that is one of the most basic skills. When he was getting lost looking at the map, and his one NCO is like, actually, sir, we're not there, we're right here, and he had no idea. That is like one of the most basic skills. And granted, now we have really cool computers and GPS, so it's really a lot easier these days, but you know, when we first learn land nav, you learn using a map, and that is a vital skill, because I don't care if you're the best tactician in the world, if you can't get to the battlefield, doesn't mean shit. So
yeah, when we used to do training and stuff like that, I would always have my lieutenants separate themselves with just either myself or another staff NCO before we would talk about where they're at on a map, because you, if they're wrong, you don't want the junior troops to hear that. You want to make sure that they know exactly what they're doing, and you don't want them to be embarrassed. And I think that was a mistake that Sobel made, was speaking about maps and shit right by everybody.
That, yeah, exactly. It's one thing as an officer to make a mistake. It's another thing if you make an egregious mistake like that and all your junior guys see it, because then they're like, oh, crap. If they don't have any confidence in you, it's a bad situation. So the fact that he kept messing up in front of all his junior guys, that was just not a good look.
Two quick things before we move on to episode two, and we'll do episode two faster. There's just so much shit to unpack, like military leadership style and episode one. They really set the stage where you got to know the characters. I love the fact that Tom Hanks and Spielberg made Sobel look like a little bitch when he drinks the whiskey in the colonel's office. Like,
yeah, oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
Like, oh, fuck, before he gets it. That's just such a subtle little dig at his manliness there.
Right.
That I just absolutely loved. And then when Winter, before they get on the plane to actually go do the mission, and he's picking every single man up one by one, patting them on the ass and tell him, like, let's go do this, like, yep, one by one by one. That was amazing. Episode two starts. The guy says, I love this part because it's so poignant about what we want to talk about this month a lot, and you'll hear some more as the weeks go on. In June, we're going to spend a lot of time on PTSD and PTSD-related issues. One of the major themes that we hear about guys in World War II of Vietnam is that PTSD wasn't a thing, but it was a thing by different names. Mm. When the gentlemen who actually were a part of the D-Day invasion cries at the end of the realistic scenes, and he says, you try to put it out of your mind.
Yeah.
I feel like these are the moments where it doesn't matter what generation you are a part of. Those are things that every soldier, sailor, airman, Marine who has experienced combat knows.
No,
you try
absolutely
to put it out of your mind.
You try.
You see him as a 75-year-old man. You're going to see him as a 90-year-old man going through the same thing.
No, you're absolutely right. You try, but let's think about the end of episode one and then into episode two when they're, you know, then what a great, great title of episode two, Day of Days. But when they're jumping in the cover of night and all you see when you're jumping out of this plane, one, the plane is rattling around. So, you know, you want to get the
and
hell out of there.
And planes are blanking in the sky. You can't see anything.
No, you can't see shit. It's dark. But then you jump out and all you see are these tracers, and you are just, and you're hearing the flak explosions, and all you're thinking from everything I've read about the accounts of these gentlemen is just like, I just want to get on the ground. It's so scary. So I don't know how you could try and try and try. So I don't fault any of those men for not being able to ever put that out of their mind.
And it was perfect because the gentleman said, you try to put it out of your mind. And then the episode is 100% about the things that you try to put out of your mind. You're restocking ammo from dead bodies, and like, no matter what side they're on, you're picking up their weapons, picking up their ammunition. And it's just scene after scene of horrificness. Like, I can't, the first thing that I really struggled to put my mind around is the idea of jumping in and then just being a part of a random unit. You're no longer a unit. You're just whoever the fuck you come across.
Can I see how scary is that?
Dude, you don't know each other's lingo. You don't know anything that they've done to train. You're just like, fuck it, man. We're Americans. Let's go do this. Let's go try to find an objective. And there's three different groups with them already. And because Winter is senior, they're going to go try to get on his objective.
Right.
Crazy.
One thing let's talk about, though, and I think it's important to understand, that's why it was so important for all of them to pay such close attention to that operation order. Because I think probably they knew that there was the chance, a good chance, that they would get scattered like that. But they knew, if they all knew their objective and where the rally points were,
a 7-click scatter is a big scatter, though.
That's a huge, huge scatter. But also,
I mean,
too,
sorry, clicks mean kilometers, 7 kilometers away.
And another thing that was interesting, and I've been asked, people have asked me, what were those clickers and why were they saying those words? Like, what was it? I think thunder, and I forget. It was like a challenge word. So, you know, you hear someone walking in the bushes, you know, you use your clicker because that was a way for them to know, okay, that's not a German, that's another American.
Right.
And that those are words, obviously speaking English was pretty for the first giveaway. But then the Germans weren't going to know the challenge words. So you say one thing and the other person knows, like, oh, if I hear this word, then I respond with this word, and it's like, okay, that's a friendly. I can link up with them.
Yep, and I laughed when the dude got shot in the ass, and he said, I fucked up my ass, and he apologized about getting shot
in
the ass.
Yeah.
That was funny as fuck. I don't want to get too much into the combat stuff about what happens, because I think anybody with a brain can look at that and see that that's
heroic.
Heroic. It's intense. And it's just a small little picture. That's why we have our next guest on, to talk about some of the other things that are going on, because we get so, especially with a series like Band of Brothers, you can adapt the perspective that that's all that is happening, but it's happening for a 20-mile radius and happening in so many stories all over the place. So we're going to bring in one of Connor's buddies from West Point. We'll have that interview now. This interview is brought to you by Warby Parker. Warby Parker makes you look sexy in your eyeballs, because everybody likes to have sexy-looking glasses. When people see me with pictures without my glasses on, they're like, damn, Chaps looks weird as hell. You know why? Because I'm not wearing my fucking Warby Parkers. Warby Parkers are a great set of glasses. You can get some starting at just $95. That's 95 bucks, man. That's not that much. Compared to what you would normally spend at a place like that, you're going to be spending a lot less with Warby Parker, and you're going to look delicious for it. They have all different kinds. All kinds of different stuff that you can get. All you have to do to get it today is go to warbyparker.com/chaps, C-H-A-P-S. That's me. That's the voice that you hear. Chaps, to get your awesome glasses. I got some of the ones that look forest. They look like they're like a green color. Just wait till you see how much those make my hazel bad boys pop. warbyparker.com/chaps. You can also get the app on iTunes so you can know what you're going to see. Like, it's a little try-on kit. You're going to look sexy with it. I promise you. Get the glasses. Get the glasses. They're going to look good on you.
All right. Now on Zero Blog 30, we have a buddy of mine who I've known for nearly 15 years at this point, officer in the Army, Captain Promotable, Pete Beer, who I played football with and spent some time with the Green Bay Packers, but we're actually not going to talk football today. We're going to have him on here to talk a little history, talk a little D-Day. So, Pete, how you doing, buddy?
Doing good, guys. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, man, we're stoked to have you. We just finished up our talk on Band of Brothers, and it's D-Day week, and Cons told me that you were going to be teaching some history classes at a school that he won't ever shut the fuck up about, which is West Point. So we wanted to bring you on and talk. But before we do that, I want to explain to our listeners what a Captain Promotable is. Can you explain that to us, Pete?
Sure, not a problem. So I'm recently, the promotion list came out for captains who are going to be getting promoted to major, and I was on that list. But they can't promote all the captains in the Army to major all at once. Otherwise, it just doesn't quite work that way. You got to kind of space it out over time. So until your sequence number comes up and you've been, you know, in the gamut for long enough and they bring you on actually as a major, you're Captain Promotable. So you just kind of have that title. You've made the promotion list, but your number hasn't actually come up in the draw yet to be actually pinned on to major.
Do you know when you're getting pinned?
I don't. It's probably going to be a little while. They just finished up last year's list from fiscal year 15. So they're just starting on the fiscal year 16 list. So it's probably going to be a little bit, but I'll make sure to let you guys know if you want to come up to the ceremony or something.
Yeah. So I think that that's one thing that the Marine Corps terminology does better than the Army, because you guys call them promotable whenever you're getting ready to get promoted. We call it select. So like if I'm going from gunnery sergeant to first sergeant, I would be a first sergeant select. Like I have been select. Like, because to me, promotable sounds like you're not in trouble, like you're able to get promoted, but it actually means that you are selected to be promoted to major. So you'll be a major very soon.
As long as I stay out of trouble. So I guess I got to keep my fingers crossed, but yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully. Maybe they don't take it for granted with you Army guys.
Right.
All right. So you were West Point graduate too, right?
I am. I was the class of 07, played football with Connor, and I'm an air defense officer right now, and I just got back to the academy as a professor here. So looking forward to my time here at West Point again, and not having to be a cadet will be pretty nice.
Actually get to experience some stuff and have a beer or two whenever you want.
Exactly, and not have to worry, just always be on guard. It's been awkward for me being here on post and not having to just always be watching out and make sure I'm doing everything exactly right, looking for the next officer that's going to yell at me. Like, I'm the dude who does the yelling now, so I don't have to be quite as on edge all the time.
Yeah, love it's it. A nice love feeling. I brought Chaps up last football season for his first time, and his immediate NCO blood kicked right in, and he was looking around, looking for eight up cadets and officers and enlisted guys that he could chew out.
Yeah, I don't think that ever goes away, man. I still go to base for like medical appointments and shit like that. So whenever I'm on base, especially when I see a Marine, because I expect like Marines on Air Force Base specifically to be like the embodiment of the Marine Corps. So when I see a small little uniform discrepancy, I'm just like, you nasty motherfucker. Like, why is your chevron turned like half a little centimeter off?
And they're probably wondering, who's this guy with a beard coming to yell at me right now?
Yeah, man. Like, I saw people that I worked with at school this week when I took my daughter to an appointment, and they were – I went up and I was like, hey, what's up? And they did not recognize me at all. I had to explain to them who they were, who I was, because I look so different now, I guess. And they said I looked a lot older, which was kind of fucking rude, but – So anyway, let's get into what you're doing at West Point. So you're going to be teaching this week – We celebrated, not really celebrated, but remembered D-Day. So the reason why we wanted to have you on specifically was to tell some of the favorite stories that you have from about D-Day and surrounding D-Day that people might not know. Did anything really come to mind when Connor first approached you about the issue?
Well, when I was first thinking about it, knowing that you guys are affiliated with Barstool and Sports and stuff, I kind of picked up some of my favorite stories of some of the former athletes, specifically West Point and Annapolis football players in their kind of roles in D-Day. So I thought that would be an interesting way to kind of tie sports to war. And then I know Collins is going to love hearing the Army football slant on things too. So I thought that might be some interesting stories for you guys.
Chaps will hate it, but yes, you're correct. I'll love it.
I'll tolerate it.
Well, don't
it.
Worry. I have a special one for Chaps. It's not all right. Exactly D-Day related, but it is Marine related. And I think
oh, hell yeah. Well, at least one good one.
There we go.
So what do you got?
All right. So one of them, there was a Lieutenant Henry Romanek, who was an Army football player, and he played in the Army-Navy game right before D-Day. So it was, I think, November 29th. They were playing in Philadelphia in front of like 98,000 people. So you got to think, in the 40s, 98,000 people in a stadium is pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's huge.
I mean, the Army-Navy games now don't even have that many. But he was a two-time starting tackle, both offense and defense in the Army-Navy game, right? And actually, once Pearl Harbor hit, the academy started spinning up the program from being 4 years to 3 years because they needed to get officers into the field like right now. So he actually was supposed to graduate in 1944, but ended up graduating in 1943 and became a combat engineer. And so he was on one of the landing crafts during the invasion of Omaha. He was on Omaha Beach on D-Day. And so he was a combat engineer, and his job was to clear the fields of some mines and obstacles and also mark the beach for the best landing points, right? Well, they're getting ready to land. And his coxswain, it was a Coast Guardsman, was actually manning the LCM, the landing craft. And as soon as the guy unlocked the doors, the coxswain gets shot right away. And all the infantry guys are in the front of the landing craft, and they're all getting shot too. And so it's just absolute mayhem when you hear him retell this story. And as he's trying to urge his men forward, like, they're all just bailing out of the landing craft, jumping into the water. And he says he's about to jump into 5 feet of water, and before he even hits the water, he feels the bullet hit him in his left shoulder. And so he's shot before he even hits the water. And as he's in the water trying to, you know, he's stunned, trying to figure out what's going on. The only thought he can have is he looks down at his class ring, his West Point class ring, and he thinks, I cannot lose this damn ring. And so he clenches his fist as hard as he can, and he starts trying to make his way to shore, right? Like, Cons, I know you love that ring, man.
Yeah.
So, like, that's the one thing in his mind, is like, I can't lose this ring. And so as he makes his way to shore, a Navy corpsman, you know, finds him. He's a medic from the Navy corpsman, grabs him and kind of pulls him to safety behind one of the barriers there. And they finally make their way to the shingle, which is the big overhang of overhang of land that kind of gives them some protection from the pillboxes. And the first thing that Henry Romanek says, like, after he's been shot, is he looks over at the Navy corpsman and says, I played in 2 Army Navy games, and I didn't know Navy guys could be this nice. Thanks a lot.
You saved my life. Really appreciate that. I've hated you for a few years, but really appreciate you today.
Right? Wow. Couldn't believe it. I thought that was just an awesome story. And he ended up living, and they, you know, he went back to they took him back to England and got him patched up and everything like that, and went on to do some great things in Europe. But yeah, I just thought that was a really interesting story. From an former Army football player that was there on D-Day.
Yeah. No, and I always we always hear, like, you know, enemies today on the field, but then we'll fight together on the same side in battle after they graduate. And that it certainly is true, but rare is it that you get a story like that where it's direct interaction between Army and Navy like that, to where you would, your first thought would be, man, I used to not like these guys at all, but I'm sure glad to see you today.
Right. I just thought that it was crazy that the first thing to pop into his mind was Army football, the Army Navy game.
Yeah, good stuff. What else you got?
So just another one on the Navy side of the Army Navy game. William Leahy, I believe that's how you pronounce his last name. He played in the Army Navy game in 1941 as well, and then he was in the crow's nest on the USS Texas during D-Day, which I really think that when you hear histories of D-Day, you don't really appreciate all the stuff that the Navy and the then Army Air Corps really did. You really only kind of picture the soldiers storming the beach, right?
Right.
Yeah. Especially the Navy aspect. I think that Band of Brothers brought in a lot of the Air Corps shit, but the Navy part, it's because you just assume Navy, it's going to be Pacific because they're with the Marines.
Exactly. Exactly. But yeah, they were. So, I mean, there was over 5,000 ships in the English Channel. They said it stretched 20 miles wide. So can you imagine, like, 20 miles of ships coming across that channel?
It's just wild.
It's hard to even fathom. But, yeah, William Leahy was in the USS Texas Crow's Nest actually directing fire. And so, like, their orders, like, they had, I think they had 6 battleships there, and he was one of those battleships, and their orders were not to fire until fired upon. So he's, like, sitting in the crow's nest just waiting to get fired upon by the German guns. And all of a sudden he can see, you know, he has his binoculars in the distance. He can see 2 puffs of smoke. And he's like saying to himself, they're coming. And his captain tells him direct orders, like, you cannot fire until, like, they land in the ocean or land in the sea channel in front of us. And they land right in front of him. And then he spent the whole morning directing fire from the USS Texas's 14-inch guns onto Omaha Beach. And he said he was using the single spire from the church in Vierville to coordinate fire. So there's one little town there right near Omaha Beach, and he was just loading down as much fire as they could. And those those guns on those battleships did an amazing job lightening up the defenses of the beachheads. And if you were to think that if they weren't there doing that, how much worse the landing would have been for those soldiers on the ground. Like, they did an amazing job doing that. And actually, Ernest Hemingway was on one of those ships reporting, and he said that it sounded like freight trains for the whole morning, just going over the top of their heads. And if you can imagine, those soldiers in those landing craft are just hearing German guns firing back and forth and the Navy guns firing back and forth. That had to be one of the loudest, like, instances of humanity that's ever been on Earth. You know what I mean? Like, I can't even imagine how loud that would have been.
Insane. Yeah, dude.
Just absolutely crazy. But no, but you're absolutely right. Cause I mean, the Germans had such a decided advantage when we came up onto those beaches, and just like Chap said, you forget about all the other services that went into allowing us to storm those beaches. So it is important to remember that it was more than just the Army landing on the beach that day and our allied armies landing on the beach that day. It was so much more help from the Air Corps and the Navy.
Oh, right, right. And they, another interesting one is that, for us talking about the Air Corps, Robin Olds, he was West Point grad. He played football too, right? He was the son of Major General Robert Olds,
right,
who flew in World War I. And anyways, this dude, Robin Olds, flew a P-38, right? And their direct orders, I think they said there's like 5,000 fighter aircraft that were in the skies that day. And their direct orders were to only fire on the Luftwaffe. Don't fire on anything you see on the ground, no matter what, because it might, like, there's going to be so many people down there. There might be Americans, like, you won't know, right? And so he recounted that he wanted so badly to, like, fire on these pillboxes and stuff, but he had to follow direct orders. And as people may or may not know, the Luftwaffe wasn't even around that day. So of those, like, they didn't even try to counter the Germans didn't try to counterattack with the Luftwaffe. So of those 5,000 fighters that were in the sky that day, not a single one was shot down by the Luftwaffe. So really, you had this Army Air Corps up there ready to help, and they were kind of rendered useless by the orders to not fire onto the beaches itself, which, I mean,
5,000 is so many in the sky too. Like, it's just insane.
Right?
Especially in such a small area, because you think about that, it's this huge, huge area, and it's really not. I mean, it's not that big. Like, 5,000 planes and the parajumper, just like, it's fucking wild. Like, I think that was the biggest thing in Band of Brothers for me, is putting all of it together, because you hear these stories, but actually getting a small little visual of it. And all of these things are happening at the same time. It's like, I always want to talk to the dudes and be like, did you guys realize that you were essentially like the Patriots if they would have beat the Giants? Like, you went 19-0. Like, you guys are going to be like those dudes riding in on the ships, the guys in the crow's nest. How many legends are coming out of just that one battle? Like, it's unbelievable.
And it right.
Oh, right.
Go ahead, Pete.
No, I was just going to say, there's over 150,000 people partook in the D-Day operation on D-Day. And there's just countless numbers of stories that you can pick from. Mm-hmm. That are just amazing to hear.
Yeah, and I mean, we kind of lose sight of that now in the battles that we fight now. It's kind of more small unit tactics. So you can watch movies, you can watch Band of Brothers and kind of get a visual, but we don't have the capacity to fathom what that actually looks like in real life, because I have never seen 5,000 planes in the air. I've never seen 20 miles worth of ships in the sea. It's just baffling when you try to wrap your brain around the numbers on D-Day.
Right? Totally. It's just, but
I don't even think it's possible. I don't think it's possible to wrap your head around
it. I would agree with that.
No, yeah.
I mean, 150,000 people fighting is crazy.
Yeah. And even if you saw it firsthand, you still couldn't appreciate the magnitude of it because you couldn't even see 20 miles. Like, the only way you would be able to really understand it is if you were in a plane like 30,000 feet in the air, looking down and then seeing everything that was happening.
Right. That's wild.
Yeah, because if you, like you said a minute ago, whenever there's 20 miles of channel and of just boats, like, you can't see the first boat, the last boat, you can't see the boats behind you, and there's stories of all those men, like, what they're going through. It's just an unbelievable set of circumstances that those guys had to go through. One of my favorite parts, and I want to talk to you as a professor of teaching warriors, are you going to emphasize the human aspect of it too? Because I feel like when we talk about D-Day, we don't talk about the guys that are riding in on the boats that are covered with vomit because they're so scared. We always talk about it with an iron chin, like, type of mentality, but that's clearly not what was happening. They were pushing forward despite fear, like, in teaching that fear is okay, because those boats were filled with vomit and people shitting because they were scared about what they were actually coming across. Is that something that you guys teach at West Point too?
Well, I think it's important, yes, to focus, not only focus on the tactics and the overall operation itself, but to understand the human aspects of war. I think that makes our cadets here better future leaders, because they're going to understand the personal interactions that they're going to have down the line when they're lieutenants. That it's not just, I need to understand Battle Drill 1 Alpha and put it into put into play in this situation. They need to understand that there's a tremendous human element to being a leader in any armed forces, not just the Army. And then that human element is what's going to really make you a successful leader. And so, yeah, it's important to bring it down to a personal level when you're teaching stuff like this.
I completely agree. And I also have a theory, I don't know if you've heard it before, that every single platoon is just like the characters on Saved by the Bell. Would you agree with that?
Well, I would be interested to hear you elaborate more on that theory, but I would say that every single platoon definitely has a cast of characters, and they're in no single platoon is the same. And so that's why leadership is all it's a human business. Like when you're an Army officer or a military officer or even an NCO or whatever, it's a human business that you're in. You have to be able to relate to these people that are all different, coming from different walks of life. And you have to be able to inspire them and lead them to do what is necessary in possibly times of great conflict and danger. And so you can't just apply one single rule to everything you do. You really have to be able to relate to these people on their level. And I guess they could all be like the cast of characters from Saved by the Bell, if that's the way you want to look at it.
Yeah. Well, we really appreciate you coming on and taking the time to come on with us.
Well, hold on, chaps. Chaps, we gotta get you a Marine story.
What's your Marine story? I thought he was doing a dig at me with using the Navy guys as the Marine story.
This is one of my favorite stories, and it's about Pearl Harbor, not about D-Day, but it involves a Marine named Alan Shapley, or could be Shapley. I'm not sure the pronunciation of his name. And he had recently got promoted to major. He was a captain. I think he got promoted to major on like December 6th, right? And so his new orders were to actually return to California and lead a unit there, but the boat didn't leave till December 8th, right? And so this dude was a Navy football player. He led Navy to the 1926 national title, right? And so he was stationed on the USS Arizona, and he couldn't leave till the 8th. And he was actually like really excited because he was the first baseman and coach of the USS Arizona baseball team. And they had a big game scheduled for December 7th against the USS Enterprise. We all know it kind of went down on the morning of December 7th. So he was stationed on the USS Arizona. And as the attack's happening, him and his Marines were supposed to be up at the gunnery directory station, which is on the main mast, 90 feet above the ship. So as the attack's happening, him and his Marines go up to the top of this gunnery directory station, 90 feet above the ship, right? And they realize that the gun that they're supposed to be operating is supposed to be firing out at other ships, not other planes. And so they can't even get the angle correct to be shooting at these planes. So they realize, all right, we need to get back down and do something else. Well, the deck of the USS Arizona is now afire. And so like all his soldiers or his Marines were saying, no, we're roasting up here. Like they were literally roasting alive. It's like, all right, we got to climb down.
Yeah,
and as they're climbing down,
literally
they get down.
Roasting.
Yes. Like they're literally burning alive and the ship hasn't blown up yet. It's just on fire. And he's like, all right, we got to climb back down. And once we get to the deck, we'll figure something out. And so as they're climbing back down, they reach this searchlight platform, which is 40 feet up in the air. And that is right when the torpedo hit the Arizona that actually made it blow up. And so he was 40 feet above the deck when the USS Arizona blew up. He got thrown into Pearl Harbor. He somehow was like completely naked, 150 yards from shore. And he was like, so this dude was a, you know, national champion football player, played baseball. He was a really athletic dude. And he said he was like, so just, I've never been blown up, but like so shocked and had no energy in him or anything. He could barely even swim to shore from where he was, but he eventually swam to shore and survived. But that's just crazy to me that somebody was on the mainmast 40 feet above the deck when the Arizona blew up and lived to tell about it.
Amazing. Crazy.
Right? That's just
the fighting spirit of a Marine.
Like getting your clothes blown the fuck off. Like is
that's wild to think about.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah. But yeah, if I can, I want to tell your listeners, so, you know, you can read a bunch of books about World War II, and there's a lot of good books out there, and some give you really good overviews of things, but two really good books to read if you want to get down into the weeds, some really good stories. One is called The Forgotten 500 by Gregory A. Freeman. It's a story of the OSS, which eventually became the CIA, and how they were working to get 500 pilots that were downed in then Yugoslavia, now Serbia, back to safety. And that's a really, really awesome story. And another good story to read is called The Last Mission of the Wham Bam Boys by Gregory A. Freeman. And that one's a little dark. It's a story. They're both true stories, but this story is about German civilians killing American POWs. It's two sides of World War II you haven't really heard before. And they're very interesting to read and really brings a new light onto the whole, you know, the whole time period there.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for coming on. Congratulations on your soon to have gold oak leaf that'll be on your collar.
I appreciate
pretty
that,
dope.
Jeff.
Major is a huge promotion. It's like Connor said once that for you guys, for us, the first really big promotion that you feel like you really, really earned is sergeant for Marine Corps, because usually you're going to pick up corporal, but sergeant is one that you're not supposed to get. And then major for you guys is where it's at. So congratulations. Thank you very much for your service. And excited for you to go teach at West Point and teach our young men and women how to be fucking warriors.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Thanks, Peter.
You bet. Talk to you later.
This week's episode of Zero Blood 30 is also brought to you by ZipRecruiter. If you're one of our successful listeners and you have your own business and you need to hire good people, how are you going to know if they're good people if you're not using ZipRecruiter? You can get all kinds of information, background checks, all that stuff with ZipRecruiter. All you have to do to do that is ZipRecruiter.com/zero to get... It's free if you do that. It's free if you go there, which even surprised me doing a little read. It's a free thing that you can get. 80% over jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. Finding good work is hard. It's difficult. ZipRecruiter makes your life easier if you're a small business owner, if you're a business of all sizes. Doesn't matter. ZipRecruiter.com/zero. This week's episode of Zero Blog 30 is also brought to you by Simply Safe. Everybody knows I'm a dad. My other podcast that's not Zero Blog 30 is called Podfather. So I'm a big dad guy. I also have to travel. I even say that in the show that sometimes I'm up in New York. Luckily for me, for OPSEC purposes, I don't say when I'm actually there. But I trust that my family is safe because, one, I can log on and look at them. And I do that by using Simply Safe. Simply Safe, when it comes to protecting your loved ones, I'm sure we can all agree that nothing is more important. Each Simply Safe system is a security arsenal. I'm a big Arsenal fan, expertly engineered to protect each access point in your home. You can get that set up under yourself in under an hour and save hundreds on installation fees. Simply Safe is designed so that you can easily blanket your home in a professional protection, 24/7 monitoring for $14.99 a month. That's nothing. For the peace of mind that you're going to get to have your family safe, $14.99 is nothing. You can go to Simply Safe, spelled this way though, Sierra, India, Mike, Papa, Lima, India, Sierra, Alpha, Foxtrot, Echo, .com/Barstool. That's one more time, SimpliSafe.com. How fucked up is it that I could do the phonetic alphabet much easier than the regular alphabet?
Thanks again to Pete for coming on. Great perspective. Awesome. I imagine it's got to be awesome to go back to your alma mater and teach at any school that you're going to be at, especially a school like West Point or Naval Academy.
Well, yeah, so just like he said, you know, going back as an officer and especially a captain and about to be a major, there's a lot more respect that you receive. And also just like he said, you don't have to worry about getting yelled at every turn because you're no longer a cadet. Like, obviously, there are rules to follow, but... you know, you're the one maybe making the corrections now, so it's a lot easier. So, yeah, and he's always got good stories, and he's certainly a person, get a few beers in him, and his stories get wilder and more robust and animated, so we'll have to share a few with him next time you're in town, Chaps.
I'm always down for a few adult beverages. Any save rounds or alibis?
Yeah, I was actually just curious. I want to just jump right back to episode two and ask you about something specifically that happened in episode two, Band of Brothers. Garnier's... gonorrhea, his attitude towards Lieutenant Winters, and then how it changed. Because if you'll remember, he was very annoyed because right before he jumped in for D-Day, he found out his brother was killed in Africa. So he's like, well, I want to kill these Germans. Now I'm fired up. And Winters gives him the order, wait for my command to fire on the approaching German soldiers. He ignores that and just goes wild to the point where Winters has to physically stop him and grab him and say, cease fire. But then later on in the episode, they're all huddled in the back of the truck, and he's making jokes about Winters being a Quaker and not drinking, da-da-da. And then Winters comes in, takes a slug of the booze, you know, after what was can only be described as a horrific day. And from that point on, Garnier's attitude changed, and he became one of the leaders of Easy Company and one of the top NCOs. And I was just curious about your thoughts about that transition that he made.
I think it just goes to shows that Winters is the type of leader that you want. I think it's silly to require something like that you gain respect for something as small as taking a drink. But I feel like a lot of people who are going through hardship, they just want to feel like you don't think that you're better than them.
Sure.
And I think maybe gonorrhea had that aspect. I don't know, but I think it's, and it goes to show, once you've been through the fire together, you can excuse a lot of other shit.
Sure,
too. Like,
sure.
Once you've seen stuff like they just experienced together, that's how you become a band of brothers, is because you went through something horrific together. You experience a tragedy, heroic, whatever adjective you want to use, they experience that together. I'm looking forward to talk about 3 and 4. People are saying that I won't be able to stop going through. I have amazing self-control, so I 100% will be able to not watch these episodes until we are about to record. We are going to go episode 3 and 4 next week. Thank you very much for tuning in. Sound the retreat.